So, good. Welcome to this unholy hour. So, last time we finished off with our considerations on real-world networks. No, that's not true. Today we're also going to be talking about real-world networks, but with a certain emphasis that we left out last time. So at the end of yesterday's lecture, we were concerned with processes on networks, right? So if you remember the whole structure, so first in that lecture, we started off with the social signal, social network analysis problems on the, with a little local perspective. Then we had considerations with respect to clustering and, real world social networks chapter dealt with quantities that would describe networks from a more general perspective, larger networks, and we talked about certain properties that these networks possess, and that was that, but that was structurally, right? And at the end of yesterday's lecture, we were talking about processes that actually happen on these networks, which obviously have to do with the structure of the network. For one example was disease spreading, percolation problems. The other had to do with structural growth, right? So the structural growth is maybe a third class of considerations, not only that we regard the networks structurally, but also, investigate processes on them. And, the third point of view would be how do they really grow? How do they prosper? How do they structurally evolve? Okay, and there's, again, I would very much like to point you to the survey paper by Mark Newman, and for those that are even more interested, to his book on networks. Okay, so today we'll be concerned with a special topic, and the special topic is spatial properties of social relations. And that spans, the connection to one of our earlier lectures where we talked about context, right? So remember that context is everything that we can know about a user or a group of users and their interactions with an IT system or a IT system, a union of IT systems, which is then a meter system, right? We had a lot of different contexts that we regarded, especially long-term social contexts, and that was what we were concerned with over the last 6 weeks or so, because social relations are obviously a long-term social context. They span or they form social networks. So this is why we talked about these things, right? At the end of today's lecture, we might go back to short-term social context again. But at the moment, we will still be concerned with long-term social context. However, there was another class of contexts, right? And these we called individual contexts. And among these were subsumed such things as location or physiological parameters, disabilities that a person might have. And location is one of the most prominent individual context that you could think of. Okay, so the question is, how does location relate to social networks, right? And this is what we are going to be talking about today. Good. So, going back to yesterday, searching and navigating on networks, right? And you know that the exercise also deals with these things. We can ask ourselves, okay, in the Milgram experiment, we saw that, or the Milgram experiment showed that short paths actually exist in real world networks. But even more so, people can find them. So the existence of short paths is not something very, a problem that is hard to solve or a thing that is hard to get, because we already saw that even the simple Poisson random graph possesses small world properties. Okay. However, Milgram's experiment somehow showed that people do not only know or trust in the existence of short paths, but that they actually can navigate in those networks. So obviously, in order to be able to navigate, you know that maybe from robotics, A-star or other algorithms, what you somehow need is a notion of distance, right? So you must, in order to be able to navigate, as we will see, you must be able to navigate in your short-term environment. So if I want to go to you, I cannot just bump into this wooden structure here, because I need to micro navigate, but I also need to macro navigate. So if I want to go to, Alexanderplatz in Berlin, I must first fly to Berlin and then home in on the local structures, right? So then take the bus, TXL, blah, 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 you know this, right? So in order to do that, I somehow need a notion of distance or a measure of, relatedness in order to be able to navigate. And, the open question is, how do people actually find these paths? What is necessary to find them? And how does the structure of the social network relate to space and distance? Okay. So Kleinberg came up with a model that's more or less a variant of the Watt-Strogatz model that we've been talking about yesterday. And this model was actually invented to investigate the question of navigation in networks. Okay, and we'll be dealing with this in a few minutes. Okay, good. Now, what we've been also talking about in the lecture on networks is mixing patterns, assortative mixing or homophily, right? We know that homophily is the, a word for the fact that it's much more likely that, in general, homophily states that you are very much more likely to connect to people like you. And that implicitly also tells you that it's much more likely that two friends of you are connected. So homophily kind of supports triadic closure and thus implicitly the high clustering in social networking, right? We could kind of think of, maybe people do not only root on the basis of distance, maybe they also root on the basis of homophily, right? So in the Milgram experiment, I mentioned that sometimes people might route the letters or the packets to people that are similar to the target person. So similar can mean a lot of things, similar with respect to profession, similar, socially, right, with respect to income or other structures, right? That is somehow a general principle that we could suspect is at work here. And we could also subsume the distance-based things on geographic under geographic homophily, right? Because something that is near to you is more relevant, more likely to deliver relevant information, or more likely to lead to someone in this case, right? However, what is already quite intuitive is that homophily is not alone solely sufficient for routing, because if you only know your kind, you're not able to travel these large distances. And that's the same principle that underlies the Watt Strogatz model, right? If you only know the people in your village, then you won't be able to take these shortcuts to travel longer distances, right? So obviously we need all the ranges of navigatability to be able to really cover distance in what way we will see, right? So a suitable heterogeneity, a suitable distribution is necessary. Good. So, and if you think of geographic-based homophily and routing on the basis of geographic homophily, obviously, if you're too local, or if your search works only in terms of locality, then you need too many steps, right? If you would like to travel to Berlin Alexanderplatz on the basis of a, well, door-to-door type of routing, then, well, good luck, okay? So you might travel from here to Garching, and then from Garching to Ismaning, and from Ismaning to Schnitzeling and Bitzeling, and then you meander around, and you might never actually get there. While if you're only taking planes, you will never arrive at Berlin Alexanderplatz, obviously, because you just, I mean, you need a helicopter or something to really drop down a spot on the Alexanderplatz, right? So if you're, if you want to do just greedy, simple, greedy routing, what you need is both, okay? And what does that remind us of? So those that had contact with peer-to-peer networking might know this. So this is a simple example of a routing strategy, and it is a simple peer-to-peer protocol that is these days not really in practice anymore, and that is CORD, right? And this is an early peer-to-peer file sharing protocol, and it works like this, right? So the data, for example, file names, and which we might call keys, and the host IDs, for example, their IP addresses, which we call nodes, are hashed in the same key space. And this is some M-bit key space, whatever. And the idea is that you arrange keys as well as nodes on this chordal toroidal ring structure, right? And if we look at this image here, we see that the nodes, so the routers or the persons and their laptops with all the nice movies and all the stuff on it that you would like to share with them, are arranged here on this cord, right? On this ring structure. Now, the question is, who hosts what? And the thing with this distributed file sharing is that the key, K, is associated to a node, and that's successor of K, right? So if we, for example, take this key number 51, whatever this is, it might be the file name of an MP3 file or something else, there is some function in the protocol that tells you if I have this hash, I can apply the function successor, and it would tell me what is the next item that is hashed on this cord. And that's the node number 57, right? So node number 57 is responsible for key 51 as well as key 49. Okay, so this is always this backward responsibility. Now, this is the situation, and if new nodes join, they just take their place in on the cord, and if new files happen to appear in that protocol, they are attached to the respective node. Okay, now the question is, how does routing go about in those networks, okay? And again, we see that the principle is in action, that you need connections on all levels of abstraction, or all distance levels. So you need to be able to make long jumps, but you also need to be able to make short jumps to home in on the actual resource that you would like to find. Okay. And how is that done? So you could in principle do a linear search, but that is not very efficient because what we would want is a small world. We would like to root in logarithmic time. Yeah, or in logarithmic number of steps, because that's what we call a small world. And how can we do that? So each node maintains a so-called finger table, which has a length up to M if we're in an M-dimensional key space, right? And the Mth entry in that finger table, so here's such a finger table, is the IP address of a node, and that's the node that is determined by successor of n plus 2 to the I minus 1 modulo 2 to the m. Okay, so this modulo function is just a way of expressing that we are working in a ring structure, right? So we always regard addresses modulo 2 to the m. However, what we see is that if I'm node n, right, I have success, I maintain addresses of successors of myself plus an ever exponentially increasing distance. Okay. And this is what we see here. So this is a six bit space. So we have six entries here. And for example, this is the finger table of node 8, right? So this is this one. Node 8 is responsible for key number 5 and key number 61, but that is of no concern for the moment. So node 8 plus 1 is the immediate successor. That's node 10. Node 8 plus 2 is also node number 10, so we won't get far here, right? But node 8 plus 2 to the 2 is already node number 15. Node 8 plus 2 to the 3, which is 8, is also node 18. And then if you step 16 away, you'll end up at node 24. If you jump 32, you'll end up at node 43. And you see the construction principle. So with these exponentially increasing step width, right? You can cover pretty much all of the structure, right? Because if you would like to find a resource, you can use the longer steps to cover the longer distances and then the ever shorter steps to home in on the actual thing, okay? And in the end, what this results in is a rooting in logarithmic number of steps. Okay. And that's the same principle we need when we want to root in social networks, as we will see. Now, back to the Kleinberg model. So the Kleinberg model, as it was stated on three slides ago, is a variation of the Watt-Strogatz model. And it works like this. Okay. So first of all, we put our nodes on a regular grid. And in that regular grid, we measure distance with usual Manhattan distance. So that means if I want to measure the distance from this node, I would have to go one to the side and two up. Okay, so that's the usual Manhattan distance. Now, there again, as it's a variant of the Watt-Strogatz model, we have two things. We have local connections and we have shortcuts. And the local connections are realized by the fact that each node is connected to all nodes within a distance that is bounded by the first parameter of the Kleinberg model, and that's Q1. Right? So here in this case, Q1 is 1. That means that this node is connected to this, 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 and this. Okay? So to all nodes in a distance of at most 1. And additionally, each node has Q2 many other long-range edges, and the probability that an edge to node J exists is proportional to the distance taken to the power minus alpha. Okay. So alpha controls the distance to these long range contacts in effect, right? The smaller alpha is, the longer you get, okay? Because the probability, for example, if I'm this node here, I'm node U, I have four regular contacts, so that the distance boundary is one, and I have two long range contacts, and the question is, where do they end? And I randomly select the target of these with this probability distribution, right? So I draw Q2 edges out of this using this probability distribution. And the larger alpha is, the higher the damping factor is. So I have a smaller probability of going very far. And if alpha is small, I have a higher probability of going quite far. Okay? So that's this very simple model. Okay? Now, we need to be a bit more precise in terms of what we understand by rooting in general, right? So obviously, if someone has a global view, right, if someone has a map with all the people on it and all the addresses and, well, that type of global knowledge, then rooting is not very hard, okay? So if I want to send a package to my father, who lives 500 kilometers away, I just know the address, I write it on the package, I give it into the postal service, and they will kind of route it to my father because they have global knowledge. They know all the addresses, they know where everything is. But that is not what we would like to simulate here, because in general, if I would ask someone of you, find me an expert on nightingales, and in try to find out what they eat, because I tended to find a little bird. I don't know, maybe I'm Bob Ross, yeah, and I tend to find an animal that I would like to bring up, and find me an expert on nightingales. That's hard, because I mean, is there something? Maybe you can look that up in Google, okay? And that's global knowledge again, because Google would like to, or does, index all the websites, okay? But if you hadn't Google, what you would need to do, you would have to think, well, good, I'm at a university, TUM. Does TUM have a biology department? Okay, I don't know. I'll have to look that up. If I happen to find the biology department, I need to go to the biology department, look up, is there some animal researcher there? And then you home in, okay? Maybe, no one does that on singing birds. Well, there's a Max Planck Institute for Ornithology somewhere at the Ammersee. Maybe you have to travel there, but it's all local, yeah? So you step in, and in that Max Planck Institute for Ornithology, you arrive there, well, a lot of buildings. Who will help me? And then there's no such thing as a global address space for these things, if we leave out Google, right? So what we would like to simulate is decentralized routing, because that's the one we're interested in. So what is assumed in the Kleinberg model and in general about decentralized routing is that each node only knows its adjacent nodes. So I know my neighborhood. So if I work at the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology, I know my colleagues, right? I might not know all the colleagues or all the researchers at DESY or CERN. Yeah? Why would I? But I know my fellow ornithologists, okay? Furthermore, we know the grid's principal structure, which corresponds to general knowledge about the world. So how many people does a certain person know? Okay. Is that 110, 15 million? This is more or less knowledge about the grid structure. And you know that each of those people knows like 100, 150, but not more. Okay. Furthermore, each node knows its position on the grid, and also the position of the target node. And what we also know is the positions and long-range contacts of the nodes we have already visited, right? If you already already had some traveling or behind you, right? So you were to the biology department, you were there, you were here, and then you finally arrive. You can obviously store all that knowledge to be able to avoid any other, to make mistakes again. So if you do backtrack, you can efficiently backtrack. That's what we would understand by a decentralized search, and any algorithm that only uses such local knowledge will be called decentralized search algorithm. Okay? Good. Now we can run some simulations, okay, in that Kleinberg model. And we would try to deliver some message with our local searching or routing algorithm only. Okay. And this routing algorithm uses a decentralized, simple, greedy message delivery schema. Okay. And the question is, what is the distribution in the number of expected delivery steps? Of course, what we want is logarithmic connection, right? So S should be something like logarithm of N, or a polynomial at least, right? So if we have something that is O of log N, where N is the number of nodes, we call this logarithmic, obviously. And if we have something log to the power P, where P is some number, we call this polylogarithmic. And that's also okay, right? Algorithmically. Now, it turns out that the number of delivery steps is very closely connected to this alpha. What's this alpha again? The alpha is just the exponent of this probability distribution that you use to draw the long-term social context. So it kind of controls how local your connections really are. Okay, if alpha is large, then the connections are very local. If alpha is not so large, then you can span larger distances. Now, if alpha is between 0 and 2, we would see that it takes at least n to the 2 minus alpha many steps. So that's not logarithmic. That's per se a polynomial, right? And while this is still some or appears to be manageable, think of something like Facebook, where you'd have a billion nodes. A billion square is already a lot of steps, right? So this is something that is not really what you would want. And the same or something similar applies if alpha is larger than 2. What you have there is also a polynomial connection. Okay, that's also not logarithmic. The only point is where we have actually a logarithmic connection is if alpha is equal to 2, because then we see that S is bounded by this function, and these prefactors here are constants. Constants that somehow depend on alpha Q1 and Q2, which are the parameters of the Kleinberg model of each instance of it, but it's a constant. And the only term that varies with n is log n square. That's nice, because that's polylogarithmic in n. Okay? So if we put up this diagram, we have on the x-axis the actual, well, we might call this clustering exponent or distance exponent. And here on the y-axis, we have the lower bound on the delivery time. So you might interchangeably use the delivery time or the number of steps, whatever, right? And we see that only if alpha is equal to 2, we have something that really works reasonably. Now, interestingly, the Kleinberg model actually works on a two-dimensional grid, okay? So actually, in this case, we're having a two-dimensional structure, and it seems a bit of a coincidence that the exponent is also equal to the number of dimensions that work that are at work here. But that's not a coincidence. It turns out that if a grid has such a dimension D, so you can easily generalize the Kleinberg model for higher dimensions, it turns out that we need alpha equal to D for efficient delivery. Okay. If we see that alpha is equal to zero, right, it's easy to see that we don't have any long-range contacts at all, because, yeah, just by the construction of it. So we only have our localized neighbors, and that's the same as with what Strogatz, you have to travel on the ring, right? And the Kleinberg model itself also has periodic boundary conditions. So in essence, while the Watt-Strogatz model actually for a respective dimension D equal to 1 was such a ring, it's the same here. Yeah. So the Kleinberg model in dimension D equal to 1 would be a ring. And if we draw this thing here, it would be something like a torus. Yeah, it's not very well drawn. Maybe would be much better like this. Is it better? I don't know. Okay, good. So in a torus, you have boundary conditions here as well as here. Okay, and the grid that we had for the Kleinberg model is just folded in these two directions, right? So this is basically identical to the What's Strogatz model, and you can vary this dimension as you like, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it always takes alpha equal to T to D for efficient delivery. Good. Which is shown by some detailed analysis. Good. Okay. Now, what's nice is that if we actually have long-range contacts that are suitably distributed, what we only need is distance. We need a measure of distance, and then we can greedily root. So in terms of the Milgram experiment, this just goes like, well, if I want to deliver something to the East Coast, and I know that the guy lives at the East Coast, all I have to do is to root to someone that is as close as possible. Right, so I have to have a notion of distance, and if I can employ my suitably distributed long-range contacts, everything will be okay. And as we saw, this has its applications in peer-to-peer systems. Now, what's a more subtle explanation of this alpha equal to D dependency on a grid of dimension D, right? So let's assume we're starting from a node U, okay? And what we would then like to do is we would, for the moment, like to partition all other nodes into sets. And these sets are indexed with these numbers, which go up to log n, okay? So each such distance set has a distance to U between 2 to the I and 2 to the I plus 1. So we are having a exponential distance there, okay? And this is also visualized by this, painting here that you might know. So it used to hang in a lot of kitchens a while ago, and that's a drawing of, well, New York and the world, right? So you know the people in your block, right? If you're in 9th Avenue, you know all the people that live there. And the next granularity would, or you might know the people in on your floor. Next level of granularity might be that you know the level, the people in your block, then the people in your part of the city, so your hood, and then it goes up and in ever increasing steps, and at the end you're in such dimensions such as the Pacific Ocean and stuff like this. Okay, and if we do that, we see that only alpha equal to D ensures that these long range contacts are evenly distributed over my ring sets, okay? And if you imagine, for example, what it takes in two dimensions, right? And if you build such a ring system, you would see that you have to take alpha equal to d to be sure that my long range contacts are evenly distributed. And why do they have to be evenly distributed? Because I need to be able to cover any such distance efficiently to be able to route. Okay, so that's this. And if alpha is larger than d, we are having a bias with respect to smaller distances. So I might be much more likely to have several of my long range contacts, too many actually in my vicinity, and too few that cover medium and long range contacts. And if alpha is too small, then I'm having a bias towards larger distances, okay? Which means that I do not have sufficiently many long-range contacts to be able to navigate around my neighborhood in those medium term directions, okay? Okay. Now, Milgram not only conducted the experiment in terms of that he could follow the paths, but he also asked people about their routing decisions. And it turns out that while early on the path people choose geographic proximity, later on they would use other measures, for example, similarity of occupation. And we will see in a moment how we can route with respect to occupation, okay? Now, other people also made experiments and tried to verify this Kleinberg claim. And this part of the lecture is based on a survey article by David Lieben-Novell, which is one of those researchers working closely on, spatial properties of social networks or social geographic information processing, whatever their work groups are denoted as. And there is, for example, one group at ETH Zurich that does that, Professor Raubal, where one of our team members worked for a while. And there is also people, I think, at Caltech that work a lot on this, Hecht, for example, and others. There's a whole bunch of researchers publishing a lot on these things, right? Now, these guys did an experiment to verify this on real social networks. And what they did, they crawled livejournal.com, which is, a simple social networking, social media site. And they crawled around 1 million users, right? And then what they did, they simulated the Milgram experiment on the friendship network using greedy, decentralized forwarding and geographical proximity as a criteria, right? So here, what we see is a distribution of the data set, and the actual red edges are the friendship links, and this is distributed on the U.S. continental geographic area, where you can see that here, for example, you're having Florida and so on, West Coast, East Coast, and it's not evenly distributed, right? So there are a lot more people living on the coast than here in the Midwest, okay? But that's only reflecting what you would also find in normal population density maps, and it will play a role in a second, okay? Now, the result of these experiments was, okay, efficient routing is possible, and the details are given in that paper, and slightly more details are also described in the survey paper that is the background reading for this part. However, when they tried to investigate Kleinberg's, the coefficient alpha must be equal to the dimension of the geographic structure that we are working on, so in this case two-dimensional, they found that this is actually not so much the case, right? Because the probability of friendship as a function of distance, if you plot this, so here on the x-axis you have the distance, and here you have the probability of two people being friends, this reveals that alpha is around 1, okay? So how does that relate? Remember that these are the long-range contacts, so this kind of neglects the local connections and asks, so what's the actual distribution of contacts as a function of this parameter alpha? Okay, and we know, Kleinberg says, and Kleinberg analysis says, that we need alpha equal to 2, but what we find here, in effect, is that the social network that they crawled actually shows that we're having something as d to the minus 1, in this case as the distribution, right? So alpha is actually 1. Nevertheless, it shows that efficient routing is still possible. So the number of steps that are taken to deliver messages in that experiment is also logarithmic or polylogarithmic, right? So this probability distribution goes as something theta d to the minus 1, and this theta is just the Landau coefficient. So you know that there are Landau symbols O of small O of theta omega and small omega. So, and these are denote classes of functions that grow at most as fast as something. Yeah, so O of log n, and theta denotes the class of functions that grow as exactly as this, right? So theta of something is just O of something intersecting with omega of something, right? And omega denotes the class that grow at least as fast and at most as fast, so the intersection is exactly as fast, okay? And this is what we find, okay? By the way, this is also something that you're expected to do of your social network here in the class. So we will see what comes out there. So this is part of the exercise if you're doing the exercise, okay? Good. But that's a surprising thing, and we don't know how to go about these things. What shall we do with that? Okay. Good. So there are other studies that also seem to confirm this, right? So we're able to do efficient decentralized routing with geometric geographic proximity as a criterion. And what we still find is that the long-range contacts are distributed with a coefficient of alpha equal to 1. Now, thinking of why this is the case, you would quickly arrive at the idea that the Kleinberg model assumes that there is uniform distribution of nodes on the grid, okay? And this is not the case because people, especially in the U.S., are not equally distributed. So in the Midwest, the population density is much smaller than, for example, in New York City or so, right? And, well, this shows you that, for example, if you want to route from coast to coast, it's okay if you take or cover the distance there, but you might want to have actually more local connections to be able to efficiently route because the location density is much higher there, right? So you need a bias towards smaller distances to be able to effectively navigate in these highly populated areas. So this is the explanation that because of a non-uniform density, alpha is not necessary, does not necessarily have to be equal to the number of dimensions. Now that made people come up with a modified Kleinberg model. So we might denote for the moment the dimension as K, and this modification is the rank-based friendship model. Okay. Now, in the original Kleinberg model, at each grid point there was one person. Now we can have more than one person at each grid point, and the probability for a long-range contact V having a starting node U, right? So I'm node U, and I ask myself, what's the probability that some node V is one of my long-range contacts? So this is the probability distribution that I use to draw my long-term context of, is then 1 over rank U of V. Now, what is rank U of V? So rank U of V is the number of people who live at least as close to myself than V does, okay? So I'm node U, okay? And there is V, right? And the number of people that live as close to me than V is that rank UV. So what this does in effect is that I sort my candidate nodes according to distance. Okay. Now, if we're having a uniform population density, then this rank U of V just goes as theta of d to the power k, right? If you think that over, this is just the case if we're having a uniform probability. And there we know for this uniform case that the actual Kleinberg claim is fulfilled. The question is, what is the case if we're having different rank functions, right? Now, the finding is that for non-uniform geographic distribution, we also can effectively root, right? And it tells you that if we're taking the parameters Q1, so the number of short-term contacts, as 2 times K, and Q2 only equal to 1, so I'm only having 1 long-range contact, then I'm still able to navigate in polylogarithmic time. So T is something in the order of magnitude of O log N to the power 3, right? And if you visualize that, so I'm a CDC, and these green things are concentric balls around me as a CDC, and each ball's population increases by a factor of 4, right? So it's a ball because of Manhattan distance. So because of Manhattan distance, something spherical is just deformed as a geometric like this, right? And what we find is that if we, as a resident of C, as a starting node, if I choose a rank-based friend, I'm 4 more times likely to choose a friend at the boundary of one ball than a friend at the boundary of the next larger ball, right? So this is just this exponential connection that we find and that we would, in essence, also like to have for this polylogarithmic routing, okay? And this is just the same structure here. So you can see that the diameter of the balls depict the number of nodes that are actually present at that particular grid point. So that is why we have non-uniform distribution possible. And this is just the rank-based social network that we have generated from this random population distribution, right? So this is the rank-based friendship network that results. And we can see that this is actually also the case that we can have polylogarithmic routing there, okay? Good. Okay. Now, what we can also do, there is several other versions of this or modifications of the original Kleinberg model. Kleinberg himself published a version where the random expectation in terms of the routing distance is not only taken over the random construction of the network, but also over that the routing is taken into consideration with respect to any fixed target node, right? So you can also do an expectation with respect to that, okay? And so what we have to do is we would not only have to conduct this expectation with respect to that random construction, but also with respect to that target node's choice, okay? Good. If we do that, and if we choose these node pairs uniformly, we find that the routing from dense points to other dense points is not so hard to achieve, right? But if we also take into consideration that we might sometimes need to route to people that live in not so densely populated areas, these might then be hard to route to. So if you do experiments like that, you must ensure that you don't have a bias in these experiments, because if you randomly draw your target nodes, you're much more likely to draw them from densely populated areas, right? Which in turn might give you a bias in terms of what you think is necessary to effectively route, because you're in essence measuring only what it takes to route from densely populated to densely populated, but in essence you also need to be randomize over people that live in the Midwest. Maybe your construction doesn't work as well there. Okay, so this is what we have to take into account here. Good. That was what we already found. Okay. Now, what we saw is, in one of the previous slides, that concentration on geographic proximity alone is not sufficient. So if you think of how you tend to find things in your life, then you use a whole lot of different metrics to actually arrive somewhere, right? So, it's not only distance that matters, but also other things, social criteria and so on. Okay. So obviously we must also think of something else. And one example, as I said, is this occupation-based routing. Yeah. So if I'm to expect something to deliver to a lawyer, it might be a more intelligent choice to route it to a judge, because this judge is much closer in profession to the lawyer and might have a higher probability of actually delivering it in with a small number of following steps. And how can we come up with this? So in essence, it all boils down to constructing distances again, but distance how, right? And again, we're back to this ontological type of thinking. So if you would like to draw an ontology of occupations, then you can draw this, for example, as a taxonomy. And you say, well, this is like the root node, professions in general. And then typical American notation, blue-collar jobs, white-collar jobs, right? And in the blue-collar jobs, you have coal miners and steel workers, and white-collar jobs, doctors and lawyers. I don't know, yeah? And you can ever increase or continue building that taxonomy. Now, what's the distance there? And what we work with is this least common ancestor type of measure, right? So if you happen to be at some node here, right, and this is your starting node, and you want to find and you want to route something to a node here, the question is, what is your least common ancestor? Now, in order to go from here to here, you would have to go up all the way to the root node and then descend back down again. Whereas if you would like to go from here to here, your least common ancestor would be this. Okay? Now, this is a type of distance in that tree, and this least common ancestor is denoted as LCA, right? Now, Kleinberg himself once again came up with a model respecting this. So if the ontological tree formalizing the occupations is a B-ary tree, so here I drew a binary tree, but we can generalize to a B-ary tree, and if we do so and let the long-range probability distribution be b to the minus beta times the least common ancestor distance of u and v, then we find that, again, we're only having efficient routing possibilities if we make a specific choice for beta. And that's, in this case, beta equal to 1, right? So, again, we find something, as in the case for proximity or geographic proximity, I should say. So for geographic proximity, simple Kleinberg model tells you that we need to have alpha equal to the number of dimensions of your grid. Now, if you work in a more abstract space with these ontological trees, then again, we only find a very narrow range or one particular value for beta that allows us to efficiently root if we have such a probability distribution, right? So the least common ancestor, if the least common ancestor is far up in the tree, right, we're having a bias towards longer distances. So we can cover all the way from the steel worker to the brain surgeon, right? And if we're more, if we're more conservative, and allow only steps from the brain surgeon to the, heart surgeon, then we're more into this local routing. And this is, well, just the analog to long range with respect to large distances and small distances. So even in those taxonomies, you can fine tune these things accordingly. Okay? Good. If you generalize from a tree to a graph, you can say that the probability of these long-range contacts goes as 1 over a function of the path distance, and you would then also find specific parameter dependencies here. So that's not only bound to trees, actually. Okay. Well, Kleinberg then came up with another version of this, and this is called the group model. Okay, and it works like this. Okay, if you partition a set of Hollywood actors into groups, okay, and if the probability distribution for the long range contacts goes as 1 over the size of the smallest common group of two nodes, then we find this model is navigatable with our decentralized greedy approach if these conditions hold. So what we need is the groups must form a hierarchy. So the small groups must be contained in the large groups, which is again the version of it's possible to home in your search, right? So cover the large distances first and then go with ever increasing smaller steps to arrive at what you would like. And what is also the case is that the group sizes must satisfy certain bounds, which means that if we are too small with our groups and we allow groups of very small number of people, then we are kind of bound in them. So if we demand that the groups must have a minimum size, we can ensure that we have a non-zero escape probability from small groups as well. And the advantage of this group model is that you can form groups with respect to any criterion that you like, right? So this is the connection to our data mining lecture and the graph clustering lecture. Whatever you would like to have as a criterion to form groups and to do the clustering, you can do anything there, right? So cluster with respect to body size, attractiveness, whatever you like. And this is allows you to apply very many general ideas for routing if you employ this group element. And what's also an advantage is that the groups can be formed according to different criteria at once, right? So nobody would keep you from doing a clustering with respect to two things at the same time. So you can cluster with respect to body height and attractiveness at the same time, or whatever, profession and attractiveness, something, whatever you like. And this is interesting because our brain seems to be able to integrate several different criteria at the same time when we do our navigation and social networks, right? This is an interesting sociological playground there, right? And, well, with respect to this different criteria combination, you can say, strictly say that even in a, on a two-dimensional grid, you can view this as having a combination of actually two directions, right? So longitude and latitude, or left and right, right? So this is one way to view this also, okay? Now, what came up with another version? So if we take the tree model seriously, so this ontological model, we can also have multiple such hierarchies. Okay, so imagine one tree, one ontology with respect to occupation, and maybe the other ontology with respect to, I don't know, social status, which is maybe not the same. Yeah, then you can have several of those trees, and between two nodes, U and V, you're having several least common ancestor values, right? And in that Watts model, the distance was set as the minimum over all those least common ancestors, right? And then you can also, again, then investigate in this multi-hierarchy, what does it take in terms of the then several exponents beta to yield a navigatable network. And it turns out that in this multi-hierarchy, multi-tree setting, we can have a wider range of exponents yielding polylogarithmic navigation times. Okay, so in the original first Kleinberg tree model, we found that we need beta equal to 1 to be able to efficiently route. Now in this Watts multi-hierarchy, we can have a wider range. Okay, good. And, well, there are several other variants, including what they call semi-local knowledge, right? So remember what I told you yesterday about Lada-Adamich search variant, where you get the knowledge of how many friends a certain user actually has to be able to exploit the power law to efficiently route in this social search setting. And this, if you employ something like this, this is somehow semi-local knowledge, right? So you don't have the fully global view, but you extract from the nodes information such as how many friends do you have. So this is not really strictly local in that sense, but this is interesting to exploit the power law, okay? And, well, there are countless other variants. For those that are interested, there are a lot of links in that paper to those elements. Okay? Good. So, that's that. And one example that is also mentioned in the paper is that you can, for example, combine these degree-based routing heuristics that I spoke about with the distance-based routing, for example, with the technique that is called expected value navigation, right? And this is, you choose the target node as the next step, which where the probability of a direct link to the actual target is maximal, right? And this is what is called expected value navigation, right? And if we let PVT denote the probability that V directly connects to our target T, right? And you can, for example, use the simple Kleinberg model's long range distance distribution here. And if V's degree is denoted as delta of V, what we can show is that the probability that at least one of V's friends will provide the direct link is 1 minus 1 minus PVT to the power D or delta of V, right? And this is not so hard. And we can then choose V that actually maximizes this, right? And this is called expected value navigation. That's just one way to further deal with these things, right? And well, that's that. And I would really advertise reading the paper. It's only, if I'm not completely mistaken, so the relevant parts are fewer than 10 pages or so. And it contains a lot of links to the original papers of Kleinberg and the others, if you're really interested in that. So the part in the exercise is really simple that relates to that. In effect, the only thing that is expected is to come up with a investigation like this, right? So what's the link probability as a function what's the link probability as a function of the separating distance? Okay, that's something we would like you to do, and that's basically intended to deepen this lecture here. Okay, good. Now that was that. And well, we have 5 more minutes for today, because it's such an early hour. We'll skip the last 15, right? But I will quickly introduce you to the next chapter. And next chapter will be dealing with short-term social contexts. Okay. So the next chapter, as I said, short-term social contexts, and how do we deal with these things, right? And so the title of this slide set is social signal processing. Now, social signal processing is a vast field, and almost all the conferences on social computing contain at least one track or even half the conference on social signal processing, and we will see what this is and how we can deal with that, right? Good. So what's short-term social context, right? Short-term social context covers all the knowledge that you might have of IT-relevant social interactions that happen on small spatial and temporal scales. So the situation that we are currently facing here in this lecture hall is a typical short-term social context, right? So it is only valid from 8:15 to 9:45. So this is a comparatively short temporal range. And it's also valid on a small spatial scale, right? So this is only a couple of meters here, this lecture hall. And what's relevant here is a lot of things that happen, right? So there's a seating arrangement. I'm in front of you. You're sitting. There's some audio-visual things going on. If you had cameras and you would watch the audience as well as watch me, you can draw conclusions about our respective social roles here. There are a lot of expectations and rules and all these things. And that's all what covers social context. However, we as computer scientists would like to have only those things covered that actually have something to do with IT systems, right? So the stuff that is on your mind is completely private to you, obviously, but maybe if we had some sensors in there, that could measure some of these aspects. And if we could make use of them in an IT system, then this would be part of the relevant short-term social context, right? Good. So how does social, how do social scientists go about these things? So, a large part of socio-psychology qualitatively or semi-quantitatively describes or generates models of social signals and what we will find behavioral cues, right? What is much more the computer science way is we would like to measure aspects of this short-term social interaction with the help of sensors. And these days, a lot of things, a lot of sensors in mobile devices play a big role, right? Because mobile devices are always with you. And there's a whole bunch of sensors in there, like acceleration sensors, a lot of microphones, actually, and others that might be used to tell you a lot about what's going on socially in that limited spatial and temporal space around you, right? And the field that deals with processing sensor data in view of finding out something about the short-term social context is called social signal processing. And typical steps include digital pre-processing, right? So digital signal processing. And that's, for example, clear in case of audio data, right? If you have a raw signal coming from your microphones, what you would need to do is you would somehow need to convert it into electrical signals. And then you would have to quantize this and turn this into a stream of numbers. And if you have a stream of numbers, you have to process it in terms of denoising, for example, or in terms of computing the Fourier spectrum and so on, right? And you would compute a lot of different features from that. And there is currently a lab course going on about audio social signal processing at our chair. So my colleague Flo is giving that lab course. And the background is that his PhD thesis is concerned with availability management on the basis of audio signals, right? So every IT system proactively interacts with the user. For example, this telephone might ring, okay, indicating that there is someone trying to communicate with me. And the question is that appropriate in a given situation, right? And you can decide upon this with the help of cameras and others, but you could also try to decide upon this just using audio, right? So we have a lot of digital pre-processing of the audio signal. And then what we try to do is a lot of different machine learning techniques working on this, right? So in order to find out about the appropriateness of this telephone ringing, what could you do if you had the microphone data of that telephone? Well, you could find out what's the amount of talking that I do. Okay. So here in this situation, it's a typical lecture situation. So I'm talking most of the time. And that's the problem with respect to didactics, because I'm talking all the time and your brain only receives like 40, 50, 60% at best, right? Even if you're a very good student and you're totally focused, this is a very lossy channel. Yeah, and that's what makes lectures so such a foul compromise for teaching, right? Because there's so much lost in with respect to that channel. However, if you were just to determine the appropriateness of this telephone ringing, well, it could suffice to tell that in the last hour, I have been talking constantly. So this could be the data that you build a classifier on, which tells you, is this a situation where I'm doing a lecture or a talk? And it doesn't matter whether I'm a priest in a church, or whether I'm a professor giving a lecture, or whether I'm a school teacher. It's the same level of inappropriateness, right? So in order to build a system, you would have to solve the problem of speaker detection, right? So who talks when? Just from the audio signal. If you can translate this, then you might find you're having a situation like this. So here we have time.
There.
And there we have the number of speakers, right? Or the speakers themselves. And let's assume we detected three speakers, right? So maybe some of you uttered a question. Okay. But at the moment, it's like this. Okay. So I'm talking all the time and nobody else talks. Okay. Now that's one situation, and you can then go from the rough audio signal to some features, intermediate feature representations, and then try to come up with this. And in order to solve that, you already have to solve a lot of machine learning problems. For example, speaker detection. Yeah. And before you do that, you have to do speech detection, right? So if there is silence, well, silence is something different than speech, okay? Now, this might then be again classified into some rules stating how loud my telephone is supposed to ring. This might be different from a situation where you have a vivid conversation, right? So a vivid conversation maybe looks like this, yeah? So a lot of turn-taking, a lot of overlaps. Yeah, so these people obviously talk at the same time. And this might indicate a different level of availability, right? And so on and so on, right? So you have the sensors, you do digital signal processing and machine learning. You might have some model for social signals, and together with the current measurement, you can say something about the instantiation. So what's going on at the moment, right? So there's a lot of a chain of classifiers going on. And that's what social signal processing actually does, okay? What's so tempting, and that's the last slide for today, what's so tempting about social signal processing is that while individual behavior is extremely broad in terms of its statistical distribution, social behavior is not, right? So individual behavior does exhibit a lot of different individual options. So what's on a person's mind? You don't know. He could be sad, he could be happy, he could be out for going for a Coke, or he could be just on the way to the toilet, he could be dreaming about buying a guitar or dreaming about becoming an airplane pilot. You don't know. So what's on people's minds? There's a huge possibility. But since we're all expected to get along well with each other, the set of rules that govern our social behavior is very strict, right? So if I were to, I don't know, like fart very loudly, it would be totally inappropriate, right? Because I'm giving a lecture, farting is not an option, okay? So there's even very few options that I have. I cannot start dancing, I cannot start surfing for electrical guitars. A lot of options are not available. I'm expected to talk. That's my role. I earn my money. So, and the same goes with you, right? So if you were to fart very loudly, I mean, could depend on how far you sit, right? But that would be as inappropriate. Same as if you would stand up and start to dance. It would be also inappropriate. So what we find is that the social behavior is governed by uniform rules, which is nice for the computer scientists because the models are quite applicable to very many situations. And that's why we're in our group interested in social contexts. And this is what we will be dealing with in this part of the lecture, social signal processing. How do we do that? What are models of these things and basic algorithms. And again, the background reading is a survey paper that I will introduce you next time. And well, let's stop here for the moment. So see you next Tuesday then.